So, as already indicated right by Robin, what I'm going to be talking to you about today is actually based mainly on the work I did when I was a postdoc in Paris. And I was working primarily with Raphaël Boitillier in Paris Suisse, and also in collaboration with Jean-François Jolie and Jacques Pro, who Jacques Pro was here earlier, but he's gone home again now. But I also, before I start talking about the work, want to acknowledge my experimental collaborators. So primarily Mathieu Pierre, but also Anne-Marie Dumnel, and also Philippe Chauvrier. And so I'll be talking about some experiments that have been done by them and members of their groups. And I've been doing the theory, and so I'll be talking about that as well. So to kick off, I just want to say why this work on cell motility is in this workshop on cancer. So we've heard quite a bit about metastasis over, well, I've only been here for a week, but I guess it's been mentioned previous to that.
I don't know where anymore.
So metastasis is basically the process whereby some cells within a tumour gain the ability to move, they move out of the tumour, then they move somewhere else in the body and they form a secondary tumour. Now, we all know that often it's the secondary tumours that are actually fatal for somebody's life. And so the motivation behind my work is to study the mechanics of cell migration in tissues. And the motivating question behind this is this dream that maybe by better understanding the mechanics of cell motility, could we learn to stop cells moving and thereby stop metastasis. Now that's obviously a big dream, and I want to come back to that question and some related questions at the end for a bit of a discussion as to whether any of the work that myself or you could be doing could actually help or not in the fight against cancer. So this is the general
metastasis. Isn't it usually flow mediated metastasis?
It can be both, as far as I'm aware. So you can have individual cells that will exit a tumour, or you can have, as I think Jacques or somebody would have been talking about earlier before I arrived, the whole sort of tissue level flow of lots of cells, multicellular.
But so there's invasive growth, and then there's metastasis where you are growing at, I mean, I'm not a biologist, maybe someone else would clarify for both of us, but that you are, let's say, grow up in one organ and then it goes through the lymphs or the blood vessels to another organ.
Oh, is that what you mean by flow? Yes, of course. Yes, that's true. So as soon as the cell gets into the bloodstream, for example, then it will be taken all around the body by the flow of the blood. You don't need any specific cell motility for that to happen.
So you're talking
the cell
about
will
the
just
part.
Carry it. But what I'm talking about is the process. How does it get from the middle of the tumour to the blood?
Okay.
And that requires the cell to actually
move. Right, thank you. Yeah.
Actually, sometimes you make secondary tumors directly from invasion without going through metastasis.
Yeah. Okay. So the general plan of what I'd like to talk about this morning, we'll see how far we get, is I'd like to start by a bit of an introduction on cell migration on 2D surfaces and in three-dimensional confined environments. And then I'll go on to talk about two specific mechanisms that I've worked on. One, which is to do with cell motility in microchannels, so that's cells moving in micrometer channels. And then secondly, I'd like to talk about cell motility when cells are embedded in a three-dimensional matrix gel. Now, these are two very artificial situations, but as I was going to explain, in different ways, they stimulate a kind of artificial tissue, and that's why I'm interested in studying them in that environment. So I'll start by introducing cell motility in two dimensions and three dimensions. We're going to hear more about this from Dennis later on in the week, so hopefully what I say will be a bit of an introduction to what we'll learn about later in the week. So the classic picture of cell migration, cells moving, is that on a surface. So let's imagine that this surface here is, for example, a glass substrate. And then cells adhere to this glass substrate and they move. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of particular important features of this system to then contrast that with the systems I'll be talking about later. So first of all, the mechanism by which these move is they protrude along very flat extrusion at the front of the cell. This is the front of the cell, and this flat protrusion is called the lamellipodium, and that protrudes out towards the front. And the other aspect of this that's very important is adhesion. So you see my little gecko there, so just a cartoon showing adhesion. So as this protrudes out to the front, the at the back of the cell we have, or well, along here we have adhesion points. Then as this protrudes out, we have another more adhesion at the front. And then the cell, the back of the cell squeezes, and the back adhesion points detach, and that way the cell moves forwards. So that's the classic picture of cells crawling on a two-dimensional substrate. Now, the important thing about this is the adhesion. If you get rid of adhesion, this doesn't work. So a few years ago, Michael Sick and his group in Berlin did some nice work where they knocked out integrins in dendritic cells. Dendritic cells are immunity cells. They knocked out integrins, and this stops the cells from adhering to surfaces. So when you put these cells on glass surfaces, treated surfaces, they were unable to stick. So all that happened is they just slipped. They just slipped as if we're trying to walk on ice, and they couldn't move forwards. All they were doing was slipping. So this stopped the movement. However, what was interesting about this system is that as well as looking at the cells on two-dimensional substrates and showing that integrin was necessary for movement on 2D substrates, they also looked at both wild-type and these integrin knockout cells in vitro, in collagen matrices. So they put them in collagen matrices, and they found that the cells that were mutant with the knockout integrin had moved just as fast as the wild-type cells. So there was no problem for moving within this three-dimensional collagen matrix environment.
Right, it is a famous experiment. What bothered me about the experiment is if you knock out the integrins, so then they still move in three dimensions.
Yeah.
As metastatic cells, can they still, they eventually have to adhere to something, like a surface or other tissue of some sort. Can they still adhere? Can these, in other words, if you knock out integrins, can cells still be metastatic?
You mean, can they still be metastatic in the sense that can they stick to something at the other end? That, I don't know. All that was studied here was the movement aspect of it. And what they did was they put them into mice as well, and they saw that they arrived at the lymph nodes. And that's where the experiment stopped. So I don't know the answer to that.
So how does it move then?
Sorry? Okay. How do they move? That's what I'm going to talk about.
When you said they move as well as in 2D, how do you measure that?
They put the wild type and the mutant cells into this three-dimensional, and both cells move as fast as each other in the three-dimensional. And then you could compare that to the speed on the two-dimensional. But that wasn't really the point. The point was that they moved as well as if they got integrins.
Were they messy camel or rounded shapes when they move in 3D?
They're not rounded. They're very
heavy.
Yes. I don't really want to put an exact shape on them, but they're not round. So to summarise, if you knock out the integrins and you don't have adhesion, then they do move in tissue and in artificial tissue. So the question is there a different mechanism for motility in confinement? So I argue, yes, there is, and that's what I'm going on to talk about now. So in order to investigate this question of motility in a more tissue-like environment, With my experimental collaborators in Paris, particularly Mathieu Piel's group, we decided to look at cell motility in microchannels. So Mathieu Piel's group has big expertise in making microchannels, and so each of these lines here that you see is an individual channel, and we can tune the geometry of these as we like, and they're typically a couple of micrometers in width. And we can choose how wide they are. We can even change the shape of the channels, have wavy walls, and investigate the movement in that. So the point of doing this is that a microchannel like this is a quasi one-dimensional system, so it's simple. All we're measuring is the cell going one way or the other way, and its speed. So that simplifies measurements, but it greatly simplifies the theory, which is the important point. But what is useful for this in terms of studying tissues is that it isolates the effect of confinement. So in a complex three-dimensional tissue environment, there's lots of different variables that we can think about. One of those variables is the fact that the cell is confined. The mesh size of a collagen matrix or of an extracellular matrix is of order the cell size. So the cells are squeezed, and they have to squeeze into different holes in the environment that they're in. And so this studies just the effect of them being confined, without all the other complicated things that happen in tissues. And so that's the idea.
Well, that's one difference. Your channels are perfectly rigid, and I imagine that in the collagen, the cell can pull a bit on the bundles. It can make holes for itself, crawl too, right?
So that's a fantastic question. So there's two aspects. As far as I'm aware, there's two things that cells do in reality. They push, as you say, so they could push their way through, but they also can degrade the extracellular matrix, so they can eat it to get rid of it. A bit later on, I'll talk about some cells that actually are not able, their mutants are not able to eat away the extracellular matrix, so I'll talk about those later. These, they're not eating it because it's PDNF and they can't eat it. Rigidity is really important, so we tried, in fact, a poor postdoc tried for a long time to make channels with softer walls. What we wanted to see was how the cells were pushing on the walls.
And in addition, then you know also about the forces, right?
Exactly. So we were really hopeful about this. However, when I say he tried for a long time, whatever he did, the channels just collapsed because they were too soft, so the two walls just collapsed onto each other. So it was technically quite difficult, but a bit later on I'll show you some clinical results of a different system that is working
through. Yeah. Did the previous group try to put their knockout version on just PDMS surface?
Yes.
The soft surface. Okay.
Soft surface. No, what they did is put it on patterned surfaces. So they had... So they took the wild type and put adhesive surfaces and slippery surfaces, so in stripes.
So they didn't address the issue of rigidity?
No, it's not stripes. No. Oh, yes, okay. This just shows you a cell moving in one of these channels. So the point I want to make here is the cell is very long thin. Now these cells, if they're in solution, are spherical, so you can see we've squeezed it a lot. We've now switched to an RICM image here. This is the back of the cell. I'll talk about this a bit later on. This is the front of the cell. All sorts of things, I don't know how clearly you can see that, but all sorts of things happen at the front of the cell. This cell is undergoing pinocytosis and eating fluid and all sorts of complicated things at the front.
Is it a gradient that's forcing it?
No.
Why is it moving?
Why is it moving? Good question. There's no gradient. So most experiments of this kind, and in fact experiments by Michael Sook's group in the original experiments, were done with gradients, sort of a kinetic gradient or towards food or something. Here, and there's no gradient at all. So we just put the cells in and then watch them overnight with the microscope. And spontaneously, some of them go one way and some of them go the other way. And a very interesting question is, what we found is sometimes the cells actually switch direction. And that I find fascinating because we don't know why they switch direction and what controls that. In the past year or so, Matthew Piel's group have been doing some nice experiments with making a constriction in the channel. And with constrictions in the channel, you can see that the cell will go to this constriction, and depending on how small the constriction is, it will either squeeze through or it will get stuck and switch direction and go backwards, go back again. So obviously there's a geometric effect that will change its polarity, change its direction. But in these straight channels, we sometimes see them change direction, we don't know why. Ideas range from they're spontaneously switching direction all the way through to maybe there's some dust or dirt in the channel that we can't see that's causing it to go back here.
What is it feeding the channel?
What's inside the channel? Medium.
Nothing, no polymer medium, nothing to digest, just...
Nothing to digest, just
liquid,
yes. Yeah.
How do you put the cells in?
Good question. So, this is what the PDMS looks like. It's a sort of that sort of size, and the channels are in between these two dots here. And these two wells, they're just holes in the PDMS, and we inject the cells into these holes. I tried doing it in my children's cells because I'm pushing on, but the people, the experimentalists who've got delicate fingers can inject the cells so that they go, gently inject them without killing them, so that they go into the channels. Now, obviously, when I say without killing them, we all check to see if they're dividing, to check that they're happy.
What happens if you change the diameter of the micro channels?
The speed changes.
Okay.
Yeah. There's an optimum size of channel for the speed. So if the channels are too wide, then they go slower. If the channels are too narrow, then they go slower or get stuck. But there's an optimum, which is...
If they go very quick, they don't move anymore.
If they get... Interestingly enough, the limiting factor is the nucleus, the size of the nucleus. The cell itself can deform enormously, but the nucleus is more elastic, and that's harder to deform. So once your channel is the size of your nucleus and you're deforming your nucleus, that's when the cell will get...
And that's how it moves, right? I mean, it moves by pushing against the wall.
But I won't come into that, yeah. Sorry, did I ask you a question?
So you have to have a pressure on the
input. To inject the cells in, and then you take it away. And then there's no more pressure.
So don't you have a flow motion?
No, there's no flow. So it's not a microfluidic system with flow. It's just
but when you inject it, don't you impose a flow on the system? When you just apply the pressure, you send an impulse, right?
Yes, that's right. But then, so that might kick the cells in a particular direction to start with. But then a few hours later, when we start measuring, I don't think there's going to be any flow left. So as far as I'm aware,
I think we should let Rhoda give a chance to get to.
Okay, that cell that you saw just then was a dendritic cell, but we've put tumor cells in as well. So I'm not going to talk about this. This is just general background of where I came from and where I'm interested in all these things. It's basically the cytoskeleton. So I'm sure you all know this. The cytoskeleton, you've got microtubules and actin and molecular motors that do all sorts of great stuff. I'm not going to talk about the active gel equations, but what I am going to talk about is a very simple model that we developed for this experimental system that I've been talking about. So I'm going to walk you through the model step by step, introducing elements to show you the full model. So we start just by having a viscoelastic gel in the geometry of an other's channel. So we initially just assume that it's infinitely long, and we just have a viscoelastic gel in there, which we model with a very simple linear Maxwell model. The important thing about this expression here is to say that when this relaxation time tau is very small, all we have is that bit, so we just rub out that bit, and that's the viscous aspect. And then when tau is very large, we have the elastic regime. So What we're going to do here is very crude. We're going to assume that we're either in the viscous regime or we're in the elastic regime, and that simplifies the analytical expressions. Now, depending on which regime we choose, we're going to take that depending on the pressure inside the channel. So if the pressure is low, below of some threshold pressure, then we assume that we are in a viscous fluid regime. So that's what we're going to do to start with. We're going to assume that the pressure is small enough, that tau is small enough, and we basically have a viscous fluid in our channel. Now, the active element that we put in here, the sort of biological element that we're putting in here, is actin polymerization. Now, actin is polymers in fundamental to the cytoskeleton, and actin actively polymerizes. It uses ATP, polymerizes, depolymerizes, and what's significant about the assumption that we've made here is that we're introducing actin polymerization as a boundary condition on the walls. And what we're saying is that the actin filaments are on average perpendicular to the membrane, thereby perpendicular to the walls of our channel, and that they polymerize at the membrane. So if you polymerize at the membrane, what happens is that if you've got a rigid wall, then what happens is the actin goes inwards. So I've drawn these arrows inwards. This is a flow of actin inwards. The reason why we assume that the filaments are roughly perpendicular to the membrane is that the resolution of this isn't great, but if you look really carefully at this RSEM image, you see spots, dark spots, which we think are the spots of actin. People also call these podosomes, which are like little feet. Bundles of actin that are perpendicular to the membrane. So that's why we took this assumption. So we're putting in the effect of the polymerization of actin against the walls as a flow of actin inwards.
This is a little bit similar to the ideas about hysteria movement in cells. You push by polymerization and it,
yes,
like wet soap, it just,
yes,
pops out.
Yes, it's a similar idea to that, except that with listeria, the actin is actually outside
the heat on the inside.
Because listeria is
the action force against the wall.
Yeah. So then you've got, for people who don't know, the listeria system, you've got listeria, which is the bugbear, and then you've got actin on the outside. It uses it's inside a host cell, and it uses the actin of the host cell to make a kind of comet at the back. And it's like a soap system. It pushes like that, pushes forwards. So this is similar, except the actin is inside the moving object. Okay, so to move on, we assume a viscous friction, and we make a lubrication approximation. What this means is we assume that the width of our channel is very small compared to the length. So we're also assuming that the width of our cell is very small compared to the length of our cell. So if we do that, then we can approximate the system to a relatively simple expression here, which is the form of Darcy's law. Now, for anyone who doesn't know the hydrodynamics, Darcy's law basically relates the average velocity. Now, that's the velocity in the x direction averaged over the z direction, averaged over the width there. So it relates the average velocity to a gradient in pressure. Now, if you notice here, there's a minus sign in this expression, which just shows us that to have a positive velocity, so in my diagram, positive is this direction, to have a positive velocity, that means that the pressure gradient must be negative such that it's higher at the back, the pressure is higher at the back and lower at the front. Now, I've been talking about back and front. In our model, there's nothing that breaks the symmetry apart from us. So we break the symmetry by hand, and we say that this is the front of the cell, so I now created a front of the cell, and this is the membrane, and I'm saying that outside the cell, the pressure is zero. I mean, it's not zero, it's small, but I'm saying that it doesn't change the the conclusions if we put this as a small pressure. So pressure outside is effectively zero. Then we have the cell here. And I'm then saying that because we've got a gradient in pressure, at some point, the pressure, as the pressure is increasing towards the back, if we keep increasing the pressure, we can no longer assume that my gel is a viscous fluid. So we hit some threshold pressure, and I don't know what the threshold pressure is, I'm not going to tell you, whereby we have to take the elastic limit. So this is a very crude model. We have fluid in front and elastic at the back.
Is that the darker region in the back of the cell?
Yes.
Okay.
So this darker region at the back of the cell is an RICM image, and it indicates that the cell is closer to the walls, which is indicative of a higher pressure. However, that is an indirect measure of the pressure. So that's why we did it like this, but I'm going to show you a bit later on some better justification for that. So now we have a flow of actin forwards. Now, what's interesting about this, if anybody knows all about the lamellipodium and crawling, is that in the lamellipodium we have a retrograde flow of actin flowing backwards, whereas here we've actually got a flow of actin flowing forwards. So it's a different mechanism in that sense. So we have a flow of actin forwards. Now, all of this is fine as long as our cell is long enough to hit this threshold pressure at the back, whereby we've got this effectively elastic plug at the back that the cell's pushing off. So in order to think about the length of this cell and whether it how long it is it short enough, basically, we need to remember that we'll only need to think about the friction at walls. And the friction is actually caused by polymer friction. You've got lots of polymer chains at the side. And so you've got this entropic effect of the polymers there, which basically means that you get an exponential dependence of the friction on the pressure itself. So when we include this exponential dependence of the friction on the pressure, we get to very high pressures in a finite distance, a finite length.
So this one, maybe it's naive, but momentum balance, by how do you ensure you have the movement of actin flow? So is it by transferring the force on the border?
Yes. So it's pushing. It's pushing on the walls.
And this is.
So this wouldn't work if there were no walls, because there'd be nothing for it to push off.
Sure. Does this interest momentum balance and balance also the momentum of the flow of the actin? That's what you think.
Yeah. So there is a question of conservation of mass here. I'm not sure if that's the same question that you're asking. But if this flow is flowing forwards, then what's happening to the back of the cell? I've been talking about polymerization here, but we have depolymerization in as well. And there's more depolymerization at the back because that's where that pressure is higher and there's more higher density, so there'll be more depolymerization.
Okay, so it's not a flow in the sense of a liquid flow, but it's polymerization, depolymerization.
Yeah. So the flow is induced by the polymerization and depolymerization.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Meant to be completely lost. If I look at this picture, I see that all the forces on the cell are perpendicular. Are this way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yet you are overcoming a friction and moving forward. So
yes.
Where's the forward force coming?
Yeah. Okay. So the flow is going. The flow is going inwards, yes. Like this, and it has to go somewhere because it can't just stop. It can't just explode. So it has to either go that way or that way.
Yes.
Which way it chooses depends on these boundary conditions. So I forced it to break its symmetry this way, so that it basically these arrows do this, go forwards. If I put this plug at the other side, then it would go the other way.
Is there a liquid between the cell and the wall?
Good question. From what we can see in the images, it looks like the cell is right next to the walls. But early on, we started asking the question, where does the fluid go? These are very long channels, and the cell is moving forwards. And it can't be pushing all the fluid, that long channel of fluid in front of it. And so there's two different things that could be happening to the fluid. Some of it could be going around the edge, and then, yes, there is a bit of fluid around the edge. But the other, kind of interesting thing about these cells is that they eat fluid, and they're continually eating fluid. So what we think is the majority of the fluid is actually being eaten by the cell and chucked out the other end as it goes. It's actually proved rather difficult to prove this because we put the experimenters put some fluorescent dye in the liquid to see where the fluid was going, and they nicely saw that the cells ate the fluid and ate the dye, but then the dye stayed inside the cell because the cell kept the dye, and whatever it was doing with the water, the dye stayed inside the cells. So it's been a bit tricky to. So we know that the water is going into the cell, and we assume it's coming out because the volume of the cell isn't increasing, but we can't be sure.
No, go ahead.
Just a question to what the person in front of me asked. So if it's completely normal, the normal force, then it would mean that if you had changed the friction between the cell and the wall, it shouldn't change the speed of movement. Because if it's completely normal, so if there is no
tangential force.
Okay.
Again, think of the soft soap. If you have soap, you push from this direction, yeah. It's going to slip in that direction.
But it means if you change the friction between the wall and the cell, it should not change anything.
Why not? You have to still balance the dissipated force.
But she's saying here that she's saying that the forces are normal. Completely normal to the...
Those are the normal forces, which are, you have to distinguish from the viscous forces.
Yeah, but the viscous forces are at the front, aren't they?
No, the viscous forces layer in the
two. All the way along.
The main viscous forces will be the thin layer between the surface of the cell and the wall.
Okay, so
maybe
there.
We can discuss it later. Okay, so here is a pressure profile for various different parameters of if you remember I said I had an exponential dependence of the friction on the pressure. So I had a parameter beta there that I'm increasing here. So this black line is if you have no coupling between the friction and the pressure. If you have some coupling, then you actually get a high pressure output back. This, by comparison, is the intensity, normalized intensity, from this RICM image here. So you see that it's dark at the back, which implies a higher pressure, light at the front, which implies a lower pressure.
Put a higher pressure in the back, kind of jam the thing against the wall, forcing it to move forwards.
Yes. I think of it as like an elastic plug at the back.
Yeah.
Now, this is all very well, but it's rather indirect measurements of the pressure. And what we would really like is to be able to measure the forces that the cell is exerting on the walls, which is why we started making soft walls. Yes? Oh, good question. You can't see it from there, but you can see it from the previous image I had. Yes. You can't see it from the RICM because it's in the middle of the cell, but you can see it from confocal, and it's there. It's in front of the elastic bit and back. By the way, the biologists call this high pressure thing at the back. They call it the uropod. If you've heard about the yeah.
And what is the size of the channel compared to the size of the meters?
It's about twice the size of the nucleus. But we've made really narrow ones for the other side of the nucleus and get it stuck. Okay, so how do we make soft walls? So this is the work of Mayel Adair, who has made this fantastic system that solved the problem of the channels falling apart. So here he's got a PDMS gel and he's made a short channel here with a surface. So he's got a surface, and then he's got a. By the way, this is not a complete channel. This is actually just confined in two dimensions rather than confined in all dimensions so far. But I'm going to actually hear when he's got the pillars. Yeah, that's the first one. But if he's got these down bits here, he can make channels. So then what he does is he uses pressure, these pumps here, to bring this surface down. So the cells are on the surface, and then the upper surface is brought down here, brought down, and thereby confines the cells in this direction here. So the height of these channels, the width of these channels, is determined by the pressure. And so sucking, basically. So he can tune how much he's confining these cells by this pressure that he's putting in here. So this we nicknamed the cell crusher. And when he first did it, you can imagine he hadn't quite got the tuning of the negative pressure right, and he just crushed the cells and they died. So after he had lots of fun of killing lots of cells, he got it tuned right so that you can confine them but without killing them. And so this is an image that he's taken of a cell in a channel. So it's probably easier to see in the top one where the surfaces are fluorescent, and you see that the cell comes along and pushes the sides. So can you all see that? This surface here is being pushed upwards and this surface is being pushed downwards. So you can see the deformation there as the cell goes through. And this is the focal of the cell. So these are preliminary images, and they've not been fully analysed to actually measure the deformation. But yes.
It seems that the pressure is higher at the front. The deformation is coming. If you look at the cell on the middle, and if you look at the displacement.
Could be. Yeah, it could be. I'm not sure. It's not been fully analysed yet. So anyway, I mean, what's exciting about this is that we can finally see the cell pushing the walls. So we can see that the cell is actually exerting force on the walls, and deforming them if they're soft enough. But this, as I've indicated, is technically quite difficult to do. So we're still waiting for good analysis of that. This is just what I've talked about so far was all in the lubrication approximation of an average velocity. But this is taking away that approximation and doing a full two-dimensional model. So the black arrows are the polarization of the gel, which I've imposed. So I'm saying that's the symmetry breaking of the system. And then the blue arrows here, from here, they're zero. And then here they increase. You see that this is actually the profile of the velocity. So you see the velocity is smaller at the edges, these are the walls at the edges, and larger in the middle. You might wonder what the green arrows are, or dashed arrows. They are if I include the effect of myosins. So everything I've talked about so far was just caused by the actin polymerization. But if you include the effect of contractility due to the myosin, then that active turn due to the molecular motor squeezing the gel is in the same direction. So this adds to the effect. So you can get faster speeds if you have myosin. And that's been seen in experiments when you knock out the myosin, then cells manage to move but slower. So I want to conclude this part, which is basically that it's a bit, this mechanism is a bit like a rock climber. So if anyone's been rock climbing, you might have heard of the technique called chimneying, which basically involves pushing at the sides, and if you're inside a kind of cliff face like that, if you push sideways, you can increase your friction, and that will help you climb. And that is what we think that the cells are doing here. They're pushing sideways, that increases their friction and enables them to move.
But this is why I said, I was thinking that you need a force transmission also. It cannot be completely normal. I mean, it's precisely what you see here.
He's concerned that force generation is in the vertical direction, but motion is in the horizontal direction. And that seems to violate Newton's law. You would like to see a driving force in the plane.
Exactly.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you do have pushing off the back as well, which we didn't really talk about.
Three actual force from the plug on the back.
That was my point.
Sorry. Yeah, you do have pushing off the back as well. Okay, so that was the first part.
How do you make it move backward?
Okay, so how does it change direction, move backwards? Well, in terms of this model, you would have to artificially break the symmetry in the opposite direction, and then it would go in the opposite direction. So basically, this model doesn't answer that question at all. That's a question of polarization, and I'm really interested in that question. I have no answers for you yet.
It's spontaneously happening.
As far as I can see, it's spontaneously happening. It can happen in response to signals. So we are obviously, cells are kinetic, so you can have chemical signals, so polarization responds to that. But from what I've seen in these experiments, I think they're doing it spontaneously as well, which is a really interesting question.
From the movie that you showed, one has a feeling that the two ends of the cell fluctuate at the same time. So...
Yeah, so it could be hesitating which direction it's going in, do you mean?
There would be a maximum of density of pressure in the middle of the cell in this case, or something?
I think if the maximum is in the middle, then it won't go anywhere. It might be in the process of switching direction.
It might be interesting to add noise in your model generated by cell activity, which, if it gets strong enough, will just pop it across and then have to start in the other direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're thinking about.
Remember that the nucleus is occupying a lot of space and the envelope needs to move in the other direction.
Yeah.
There can be a lot of restriction. That's why in 1D and 3D, cells tend to be polarized for a very long time. Sometimes hours on end, but it just keep on going until maybe polarization.
Yeah, I mean, when I say they switch polarization, it is on the order of hours. They will go in the same direction for several hours before switching. So all our experiments have taken over about 12 hours, and we'll see a few switches within that time. But that's, yeah, I'd love to talk to you more about this, the microtubule thing switching over and all that, because I'm really interested in all that. So we'll talk about that later. Okay, I just want to talk briefly about the second aspect, which is a different experimental setup, whereby, now these are tumor cells, these are breast cancer cells. For people who understand about these things, they're NVA-NV231, which doesn't mean anything to me, I'm afraid, but I'm sure that means something to some people. Those are the cells. Breast.
It has a metastatic potential.
These are metastatic cells. And as far as I understand from the experimentalists, these cells don't eat the Matrigel. They are embedded in a Matrigel in three dimensions. They embed it in two different ways. They embed it by putting it in, and they embed it by putting it on the surface, and it goes in itself. And it doesn't seem to make any difference to the results. So this cell is expressing mCherry-LifeAct, which is labelling the actin. So what you see there is the actin. And what's interesting about, one of the things that's interesting about these cells is they're basically spherical, and they stay spherical whilst they move. So they move in this direction, and they're staying roughly spherical. So in terms of the modelling, we model it as a spherical shell, basically. And we have a shell of gel, which is the reddish purple thing that I've drawn here around the edge, and it's polymerizing and depolymerizing. This is actin again, and we model it as a compressible gel, which basically varies the thickness. That's a technicality, the way we do that. And the important thing about this gel is that what we're modeling is the myosin. And myosin motors bind to actin and they bind, so they can bind to two different filaments of actin and walk along them. If they're parallel, nothing happens, they just walk along to the ends. But if they're anti-parallel, because myosin motors only walk to one direction, to one end of the actin, if you've got two actin filaments that are anti-parallel and the myosin is trying to walk to the ends, then what happens is there's a stress on the filaments and they contract. So don't ask me why they contract rather than extend, that's a subtle issue, but they contract. So we have a myosin leads to this active stress, and we say that this active stress, this contractility, squeezing, is proportional to the amount of myosin at that particular point in the cell. So in terms of this cartoon, the myosin are just my blue dots here, and they can be either in this cortex, this bit round the edge, near the membrane, or they can be in the bulk of the cell, and they just switch between them. And then we write down some dynamical equations for both the gel, which is the actin, and the myosin. So we have muscle conservation of the gel. We have, sorry, I've said two-dimensional gel, that's because we're just taking the surface.
Is gel being eaten up, the right hand side of the mass?
Oh no, it's not eaten up. It's you mean what is KD? It's depolymerization reacting.
Okay, yeah.
So we just have a force balance at low Reynolds number, and then this factor here is the active stress, and mu is the concentration of my myosin. So I'm just saying that the active stress is directly proportional to the amount of myosin I have. So I have diffusion of myosin in the cytoplasm and conservation of myosin at the cortex cytoplasm interface. So that's the interface between the middle of the cell and the edge of the cell. So then I allow the myosin to diffuse both in the three-dimensionally in the bulk of the cell and two-dimensionally in the cytoplasm, in the cortex. So I don't want to go through all the mathematical details given the time, but we basically did the linear stability analysis on the system. So the homogeneous stationary solution is boring, nothing happens. And then we did a perturbation, a spherical harmonic perturbation on this. And what we're finding in this analysis is we're finding this dispersion relation S. And basically, it's what we're asking is if we perturb the system, do the perturbations grow or do they diminish? And we go back to the stationary solution. The question is, do these cells move or not? And in order for them to move, they have to be not in the homogeneous stationary solution. So we did a one-dimensional approximation and found an activity threshold above which an instability appears. I'm going to show you some graphs. Here we go. So this is the dispersion relation when it's positive. So we see that we do get some regions where this system is unstable. And I plotted this as a function of L, which is the mode of the spherical harmonic. And this is L equals 1, which is the mode that is interesting. So in L equals 1 mode, what happens is the gel moves around from this side to that side, and again that way. So you get a depletion of the gel at this side and it increases at that side and you get this flow. If you include the proper balance of polymerization and depolymerization, this could be a stationary state, but I'll come to that in a minute as to what happens at long times. But just in terms of the linear stability analysis, this is an unstable mode. And the question is, what does that do in terms of the notion of the cell? So what we have here is basically that inside the cell, we've got a flow of gel from what I'm going to call the front to the back. So you've got a flow from the front to the back. And if you then couple that with friction to the environment outside, and then integrate all the way around, that then leads to a non-zero force in this direction. So this is a bit like swimming. Now, in swimming, you push the water around the edge of you, around the outside, and that pushes you forward. But this is like on the inside of the cell body. There's a flow that, when coupled with the external medium, gives you a net motion. So we have a net motion, and so we have net motion by an instability analysis. But the question is, what happens at long terms? So long time behaviour. In order to work out what's happening at the long time, we need a full non-linear treatment rather than just the linear stability analysis. So we did some numerical simulations for our one-dimensional approximation, and then we compared those with experimental data. And so I'm going to show you some graphs here. So these results, the red here is actin, and the blue is myosin. The points, the triangles, are experimental data points measured by the intensity of labelled actin, labelled myosin. And the lines are the results from the numerical analysis. And so these, to me, look too good to be true. I need to make you all aware that we have fitted the background intensity and the maximum. So what you should be looking at here is the shape, rather than the actual, you know, how come this line is so good there. That's fitted. So the maximum intensity is fitted and the background intensity is fitted, but it's the shape that's important.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm baffled again. If you could go back a slide.
Yes, of course. I'm too confusing.
One more. I want to see the picture of the cell.
There we go. Yes.
The cell has a non-zero force somehow, but there, in order to have a non-zero force, it has to attach to something.
Yes, yes. Or
there has to be a force on the cell in order for the cell to move forward.
It is attached by friction to the nitrogen.
Where is the friction?
All the way around.
Okay, so which you mean that
you see the black background there, that is nitrogen.
Okay, so you're saying that as the membrane flows backwards.
Mm-hmm.
That's what pushes it forward.
It's like a
tractor.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, these cells do or don't have any germs. I mean, these are attached to the
Okay. What's interesting about these? I can't remember, but they changed the amount of integrins they had. So they looked initially at cells that had a normal amount of integrin, but then they knocked out one of the integrins. They didn't manage to get rid of all of them.
They knocked out one of them, and
it completely reduced their motility.
Indeed. So there's every reason to believe that this is rather attached to all the fibers in the nitrogen.
Connected, attached. Some way.
Yeah, they're transmembrane proteins
I don't want to say whether it's specific or not. As specific as in, is it bound to things, or is it just sticky friction? I'm making a distinction between friction, which is the physical stickiness, and adhesion, which is chemical bonds. I don't want to say whether it's chemical bonds or not.
I understand. I mean, it's surely not swimming. It's not just swimming in the fluid.
No, it can't. It can't swim. We're very low Reynolds numbers.
Indeed.
Okay. So, if I went through this a little bit quickly, this is plotted in angle around the cell. So the zero here is back of the cell, and then we go out. So this then loops back to that. So it's a circle. And then this is the velocity. So we see here the velocity is greatest at the sides of the cell. So you have to imagine this is going round. So this corresponds to where's my cell picture? This corresponds to the velocity being greatest here and here. There's less data points here, so again, the triangles are the experimental data points, and the line is the numerical solution. And the fewer data points here than on this point here, because there were fewer images that were good enough to actually extract the velocity from the kinematograph.
It resembles a little bit vaguely narrow, so am I? You have this flow along the edge, right?
Yes.
And is there a counterflow along the center? No, right? It's just because it's just polymerization, depolymerization.
Yeah, that's what I think.
But it could still drag along some fluid of the...
There could be some motion in the center. That, I don't know.
In silicon embryos.
Sorry?
That's what you see.
You see that in CFD?
From the flows driven by ectomasm.
Oh, very nice.
And initiated by microtubules, so that's...
Yeah.
Enjoy it. That's great. It's really beautiful from the flows.
From this measurement, you could have a stress profile in your layer, and if you put it back in a model, do you get the approximate shape of the drop? Because since they're not quite spherical,
yeah,
it must be because of differential surface tension, which you can extract from the stress in the layer,
yeah,
and can you get something which looks like the?
That's a good point. We've not done it. But that's a good point.
So could this thing even swim in just water or so by its flow around the edge?
I don't know. The friction is important. It's got to connect to the outside. It needs something to hold on to. So I think you do need a certain amount of confinement. I don't think water would be enough.
Have you seen some worms, how they move by having mass waves through their body?
Like a wave.
Yeah. Mass wave through their body, and then they use that to. I wonder if people have simulated or modeled these worms. could be.
I'm sure something related. It'd be worth checking. Yeah. All I've talked about is the L equals one mode, but if you go to higher modes, then you get more complex things going on, and I sort of wondered whether that was something to do with Blevin, if anyone knows about Blevin, but that's speculation.
Sometimes you see in Melanopolia, you see waves.
Yes, acting waves, yeah.
And in fact, with finite wavelength. Yeah. Can I imagine that it happens here too, so rather than a steady flow, there might be a ripples along the surface?
Yeah, I think there may well be. So I wanted to finish actually with some very general discussion questions, which we can discuss either now or informally during the week. So these are basically two questions that I came to this workshop with. So the first is related somewhat to what I've been talking about this morning, and that's how could we stop metastatic cancer cells moving without stopping immune cells moving? Now, I'm a physicist, and I don't understand the difference between immune cells and cancer cells, and everything I've talked about cells moving in tissues and in confined environments could be equally applicable to immune cells like the dendritic cells that we used, or cancer cells like the breast tumor cells that we were looking at. So my question is, obviously, if you're thinking about therapeutics, it would be catastrophic if we stopped all cells moving, because then we would kill the immune system of the patient as well as stopping cancer metastasis. So one of my questions is what's the difference between immune cells and cancer cells? Is there some way of stopping movements of cancer cells whilst not stopping movements of immune cells? So that's one question, and then the other question is very broad and very general, and that is, what, if anything, are useful things that theoretical physicists or just physicists could do to guide therapeutics? So that's a very, very general question, and I'm sure it's a question that everybody's asking.
It's also a dangerous question, because the life scientists people might be saying, analyze microarrays for us, do correlation studies, and you don't want to do that.
Well, we obviously want to do some interesting physics as well. So those are two questions if anyone wants to. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for your first question, of course, it's, you know, it's the big question. In the context of brain tumors, which I'll talk about in one scene, people have considered this, and of course, there is there are methods that have been used, you know, the targeting certain pathways which seem to be relevant in the tumor cells and not in other cells, but they don't work very well. But there's another thing which has to be pointed out. If you have a tumor, tumors as they grow proliferate a lot, and those cells are in fact not invading. It's cells on the surface undergo a phenotypic switch into invasive cells, and cells can either proliferate or move.
Typically, so.
You might imagine targeting the switch, that is to say, prevent the tumor cells from becoming invasive. And that's something that people have been thinking.
Invasive cells, if they go more towards stem cell, do have markers, CD22 or 24 or something. And you would have to see if you could target the molecular signature of the metastatic cell in terms of its motility. Normally, people try to use the immune system marker so that if you attach something to a cell, it's like a flagpole, and the immune system is going to attack that. Here, you take a different strategy and see if you could soak or something like that on the marker so it would no longer be able to crawl.
Well, one group has found the microRNA, which seems to regulate motility in cells, which has some interest for this one.
I hope Rhoda is not asking that question, actually. I hope she's thinking about something where physicists can bring something truly novel to the table. Targeting yet another molecule, finding failing clinical trials, we've gone through this how many times. I think where physicists can bring something to the table is to think, I don't have an answer to this question. And I hope that the question you're asking is, how can we target the phenotype without targeting actin and myosin and microtubule, because or integrins and GBMs, these clinical trials are failing. Once again, no surprise there.
Absolutely.
So can we go beyond this routine and this loop and see once again it doesn't work? I think what we need to stop is motility. Well, let's stop motility. Now let's stop maybe acting, which of course will be involved in many other things besides motility. Cell division and everything else under the sun. So can we, and I don't have, again, a solution, an answer to that question, but at the end, that's what matters. You can have many under the hood, many parts, many cells, even isogenic cells, giving rise to many phenotypes all the other way around. You have cells displaying very different proteomic profile or genetic profile, and leading to this very same metastatic cascade. Let's try first to understand this metastatic cascade, and two, let's start to target the phenotype that lead to this successful metastasis. And not say, is it CD4, CD125, or CD23? That hasn't worked. That's what people have done for the last 40 years, right? Let's do a lot of this.
If I could say one more thing, there's another possibility, and that's that in order for cells to migrate, and this has been shown in breast cancer in particular, they have to remodel the environment. They have to align. It's been shown that alignment of the environment, of the ECM, is critical to rapid metastasis, rapid invasion, I should say, not metastasis. And one can imagine targeting that, namely the ECM, rather than the cells.
People are trying that as well.
But then again, how about the immune system? That if you take white blood cells in the ECM, they still have to be able to move. They have to find. Mm-hmm. If the immune system doesn't work, you're a dead duck.
I would say, I'm a chemical engineer, I think targeting the rating step in this metastatic cascade is the target of opportunity, and it's dormancy. It's not. I look at some.
The rate limiting step is what?
Dormancy, not in GBM, but many other types of cancers. It is dormancy, which can last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. That's the window of opportunity for
that. Oh, okay.
He's preventing the
transformation.
Preventing
5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, it's already on its way in a matter of minutes. So I think it's basically impossible. You have to pre-treat, patients who are at risk, maybe. I don't see clinically being this the solution. I think that it's let them invade, I know it's contributive, let them do the monkey business, and then invade to the other side, and then target these cells that they've known. And of course, you have to have diagnostic tool to assess that such cells have already metastasized, but that's, I think, worked out. But no one is target dominancy. There's no markers of dominancy. I think I have one, but I won't talk about that. That is actually extremely robustly predicting dominancy. That is not molecular. It's exquisitely beautifully physical. And, but how to tell you not physical property, stiffness, or motility, protrusion, activity, I don't know, besides targeting molecules, which I need to go back to the problem of failing. It doesn't work. I don't
know. Unless you have a molecular understanding, how do you ever convince a clinical trial to take you seriously?
Even by convincing people, it's the hopeless. So what I'm thinking of,
you still need to figure out the biological mechanism we talked about.
Yeah, but the molecular, she's invoked what? Actomizing contractility. That's not really molecular, it's physical, it's friction. And let's target friction, which is what matters, not integrins, because there's going to be another integrin, it's going to be an overexpressed compensating integrin that was just targeted.
Derek? I would like to maybe to give a much more general answer, also pose it as a question. We have some project together with clinicians. And at some point I asked him, okay, we can contribute to the biology, but not really to the clinics. So we are very sorry we will do this in the next stage of the process. He told me, well, we learned already a lot because we got a mechanistic view by the input on what is going on with the patient. And I think the first thing that a physicist can transfer, also a mechanical engineer, is to give, to decompose the possible scenarios in terms of mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a moment very much based on experience. Or a molecular mechanism, I don't know how this translates into cellular, multicellular phenotypes. And the next thing then could be to really quantify, to quantitatively model different scenarios and give a kind of roadmap that gives you, that guides the clinician and tells him something about the surviving strategy to look to say, okay, if I see this, then I should change my therapy. So in a way, we will not be able to completely predictive within the 20 years, that's what I would predict. But we might give them a guidance for the particular patient at some point and tell him how he has to combine different modalities, imaging modalities, or invasive versus non-invasive methods in order to get enough information to combine strategies that may already be present. I think that's quite general, I know, but I think that is what we can do.
Can we ask questions about the talk?
Absolutely.
Food for thought. So I have a colleague who has a paper coming out in Fasel Journal who's looked at cells in microchannels, the tumor cells. So they're not human cells, immune cells are not any different. But where a couple of things. One, you can squeeze cells down to 2 or 3 microns, and then stimulant will move. In other words, a confinement much smaller than the natural nuclear size. That's number one. Number two, he subjected the cells to first mouse inhibitors, amikacin, Y26, beta, which is a ROCK inhibitor, ML7 and others, and found that these cells were still able to move. Then he diplomized actin and in conjunction with mouse inhibitors, just to hammer the cells basically, and the cells were still moving. He looked at many types of prostate cancer cells, breast cancer.
So they were still moving without actin or myosin.
You got it. So in other words, remote activity, he thought, would be maybe limited by microtubules. And indeed, then he inhibited microtubule damage with Taxol or simply eliminated microtubule with Nocadazole, and the cell could not move anymore.
Their microtubules are important.
They're dominant. So that's food for thought. I don't know what to think of that, but because
it's there to make an influence.
But one explanation was that when cells are confined, they don't get it.
And when
they don't display or focal lesions, diminishing size, the number becomes present at the edge of the cell. So clearly, you even stress fibers disappear by and large. The actin becomes mostly cortical. And that may be the beginning of an explanation. Why that happens, there's no explanation, but it does happen. You put them on cells of narrow stripes, vocal regions, and basal cell suburbs disappear. You put them on confined German field, like you did same or cells in 3D the same.
But her mechanism didn't involve vocal regions.
No, but I'm saying the observation of fewer vocations tells you that there's less actomousing stress fibers that would drive, therefore, hitting them with actomousing inhibitors, indeed, that if they don't have much effect is a big of an explanation. So that was number one. Number two.
Maybe that's our first answer.
Okay.
Number one. Yeah.
Oh, well, so just to say, you were saying that they brought them down to 2 or 3 micrometers.
Yes.
We've done that as well.
Right.
We've deformed the nucleus as well.
Right.
But we still find the limit where they stop moving. And they stop moving because, as far as we can work out, the nucleus won't deform any further.
These nuclei were like this, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what in the cells we've had, we find a limit whereby the nucleus gets stuck. But I don't know much about the nucleus, and I think there's ways you can change nuclei and them being softer or harder. So it may be that in his cells, his nuclei are actually softer and therefore able to deform even more. That'd be really interesting to talk about. In terms of the microtubules, I'm fascinated. I didn't realise before you've just told me that microtubules could be so important. My first guess that I would want to investigate would be that if you've got such a narrow cell, you maybe all you've got left is a bundle of microtubules. You've got rid of your actin and your myosin, all you've got left is a bundle of microtubules. And then I would say, well, maybe this is just trembling, polymerizing one end and depolymerizing the other end, and that could be mechanism for moving. That's just a total guess. But that's fascinating that the microtubules are
important. So I'm asking you to send you his paper.
I'd love to see the paper.
The second thing was that now, cells were in the devil is in detail, right? Cells, both in the 6th experiment and in the matrix gel experiment, these are uncross-linked ECM molecules. So in the 6th experiment, he used pepsin extracted collagen, and in that case, cross-linked pairs are elevated, leaving large pores. And this is really very important because if you use acid extracted pairs, when you preserve cross-linked pairs, natural or otherwise, the pore size becomes much smaller. So integrins may become important after all.
Does degrading the matrix, maybe?
Absolutely, so I'll show that as well. It actually, the microstructure affects MMP production, and MMP emission is critically dependent on the macrostructure matrix for cell motility. In other words, this debate that's been going between the importance or not of MMP is real because it's critically dependent on the microstructure of the matrix. If you have large pores, no surprise, you don't need MMPs, and if you have small pores, you do, by simplifying. But a cell in the matrix, in a matrix gel, I know everyone does this, but it's truly non-physiological.
Yeah, in
the sense that these are basement membrane ECMs. So they contain things like collagen 4, laminin, but for sure not collagen 1, which is the primary ECM molecule of the stroma. And as such, you have uncrossing but very small pore size. These cells will look more rounded.
Yeah, but that just never
happens. I mean, at least I cannot think of a scenario.
I totally agree. The fact that it's totally round is, I think, because you're in a matrix gel with small pores.
Because the same in the...
There's no space for it to bled or to move
so
into
the same breast cancer cells in collagen will form, actually beautiful, dendritic pseudopodial protrusions. That drive motility, and now you have a much more elongated and dendritic protrusion.
Yeah.
This is beautiful. Model.
Yeah. Well, even the dendritic cells that I showed earlier, they don't look like dendritic cells when you put them in a microchannel. Their shape is very smooth, but when you put them in a different environment, then they're dendritic and they have all these protrusions. So, I mean, I think this point you brought up is really key because it's the point that what the cells look like, and I would say how they move, the mechanisms that they use to move, is actually critically dependent on the environment that they're in, the details of the environment they're in, whether they're the pore size, the mesh size of the gel they're in, of the collagen matrix or whatever they're in, whether they're confined by other cells around them or whether they're confined by an extracellular matrix. All these things are critically important. And I think cells can switch between different mechanisms of movement as they come across different environments. How they switch, I don't know, but I think they do.
Well, I was thinking of some similarity with white blood cell mortality. White blood cells, on one hand, have to be able to extravasate. They have to be able to get out of the blood cells and have to crawl in between cells,
yes,
where it seems to me your nucleus is completely squeezed and elongated. And I think white blood cells also may have to go through capillaries where they are extremely deformed. You might even imagine that your theory could be directly applied to white blood cells. Is there anything known about how white blood cells do this trick? It might be easier to look at them than these, you know, somewhat, these.
For me, it's the same question. For me, it's the same question. Whether it's a white blood cell or a cancer cell, I think that the mechanisms will be similar.
Okay.
Personally.
Now, for white blood cells, which I once looked at, once they find a particular gap in a narrow capillary, there's a cell program which turns on, which makes them actually express focal adhesion sites. Now, I don't know, I know you don't want to look at that.
They're fascinating.
These also seems to be again. How are you so sure that since that we know pretty well is the mechanism for motility of white blood cells, how are we sure that it is not important for these cancer metastatics?
I'm not saying that focal adhesions aren't important for these. I started it talking about the fact that if you don't have integrins, you can still have movement. That doesn't mean to say if you've got the capability of forming focal adhesions, if you've got integrins, well, why not use them?
Because aren't there often parallel pathway? Maybe you have focal adhesion sites, maybe you have viewer mechanism, maybe you have microtubule, all together.
Mm-hmm.
And if one gets knocked out, the other one still works.
Yes, I think there's multiple different mechanisms that a cell can draw upon depending on its situation. So yes, I think focal adhesions are important.
Who's ever proved focal adhesions are important to motility?
Who's ever proved that they're important?
At the right time, to our place.
Brzezinski.
Who prove it is actually another.
You see them come at the front line, you see them recycled, they disappear at the back, you can see stress fibers emerging from them. It's as close as any proof as possible in life science.
That's qualitative. So we've actually looked at this carefully.
It's not qualitative, Denise. They can put it on a substrate which is the formal and they can find directly.
You put them on micropillars and you measure the deformation of the micropillars and you get the forces, you can measure it.
So the key, and it turns out, so what aspect of focalization matters? The number, the size, the shape, the turnover dynamics, the position, which one? That data doesn't exist. I've looked, I'm really
It's a complex issue because the cell actually regulates the size of the focal adhesions and depending on the stiffness of the matrix, of the substrate it's on, will be different. Forces it exerts will be different. The size will be different. It's a complex question, but it's not.
Maybe before we go in,
can we expand a little bit more about the squeezing nucleus and
yeah.
So the active polymerization is linked to the status of the cell nucleus and how that is linked.
Okay, so I only relatively recently realized that there is actually actinomycin inside the nucleus.
Oh, I see.
Which was a bit of a revelation to me. I thought, I imagined the nucleus was just some passive elastic thing. But actually, the nucleus itself could...
So you think it's physical?
Could have some physical...
So it's highly dynamic. Marking can really change the nucleus, right? But the needs of nuclear dynamics or something.
And in fact, that might itself be something, since it changes the nucleus, and it might change gene expression in the nucleus if it gets very squeezed, and it might respond in some way, like turning on some
pathway program.
Can I ask you a quick question about your presentation?
Yeah.
Can you go back to that slide where you measure pressure profile and put it next to your theory?
This one?
Yes. So the measured pressure profile actually looks a lot more linear to me than the theory. And I think that might be telling us that because the curvature of pressure, so that's the first derivative of your velocity field, is telling you about where the sources are for the fluid. Mm-hmm. That might be telling us that basically there's no source in the middle, there's no source at the front and at the back. There are two singularities at these two edges. And that would support the idea of having thin layers of fluid crawling back from the substrate, from the boundaries, because...
So hang on, so where are the sources?
So basically fluid is all pushed through mm-hmm. with constant profile, so velocity v of x is constant in the middle, is zero exactly outside, and is zero exactly at the back, but then you have a singularity mm-hmm. at these two boundaries, and for that to happen you need to have the fluid which is constant through the cell to go back, basically, from the two boundaries.
Yeah.
And that could be represented in your model, in lubrication, by a singularity. So actually, this is very beautifully showing that something like that is plausible. I suppose you didn't basically incorporate
Laplacian
of V, divergence of V, which is Laplacian of pressure, in your equation.
No, and we were quite nervous to read too much into this, because it's an intensity measurement on RICM. I'm a bit nervous to say whether that's actually the pressure. But that's fascinating, if we do actually take this seriously and look at it more carefully. Yeah. Thank you.
No more questions? Let's thank Robert.